This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson. You can join us and ask questions during the next hour in the chat room at thepeoplespeakradio.net. And as always, you can call in with your questions and comments toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. And elsewhere in the world, 877-489-6350. And we are very privileged to have with us as a guest for the next hour a board member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and an Iraq veteran against the war who testified last week in a hearing in the United States Congress, and who has been, together with his brothers and sisters in this organization, leading the charge to explain what's actually happening over there for servicemen and women. Jason Lemieux is a board member of IVAW, Iraq Vets Against the War. Jason, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. Good evening.
It's our pleasure. Just to get a little background, can you tell us where you come from and how you ended up in the United States military?
Sure. I'm originally from Tupper Lake, New York. It's about 300 miles north of New York City. I grew up there. I joined the Marine Corps. Well, I went to boot camp on September 10th of 2001. But I joined the military September 10th, 2001, yes. But I joined the military because my father was a Marine. He served in Vietnam. And I mainly wanted the strength of character. I just had this image of Marines being the best citizens in the country. And so I wanted that, and I also wanted job security because I didn't want to go to college. Halfway through my junior year of high school is when I really started getting nervous, wondering what I was going to do and knowing that I had to do something, you know. And so I ended up joining the Marine Corps.
And you ended up, of course, in Iraq on more than one occasion, and in your bio on the website ivaw.org, you describe going back to Iraq for the second time and encountering a whole different world. How many tours have you been on, and what were the different experiences like?
Well, that's a good question. I did three tours in Iraq. My first tour was the initial invasion, so we actually deployed to Kuwait on January 21st of 2003, and that was interesting because we were actually slotted to go to Okinawa on what's known as the UDP, or Unit Deployment Program, and there's a battalion in, well, before the war, there was a battalion of 7th Marines in Okinawa at all times, and so I had just come back from Christmas leave, and we were supposed to go to Japan. But as we're coming back on a shuttle, an airport shuttle, back to base, there's a guy who says to me, "Did you hear we're going to Kuwait instead?" And I kind of didn't believe him until I got back to base, and there were people wearing desert camouflage, and we had never seen it before. But we sat in Kuwait for 2 months, invaded Iraq on March 21st of 2003, and my unit invaded at the Kuwait-Iraq border at Azubair and went all the way to Baghdad during the invasion, took the Ministry of Oil. In Baghdad, we saw the looting that, you know, has been described. It was actually kind of comical to us. We didn't understand the gravity of the situation or how bad that was long term. But that you would see like excavators and all kinds of heavy equipment vehicles just driving around on the streets as some guy just, you know, walked up to one and stole it, pickup trucks with just, you know, random items stacked 20 feet high in the back that he had stolen are looted, and like donkeys towing broken down cars, just absolute madness. But then after that, we moved down to the city of Karbala, which is a Shiite holy city.
And so I'm sorry, Jason, is it true that the Ministry of Oil was among the very few places that were carefully protected against looting?
Well, yes. And we kind of, people, well, actually, let me qualify. We protected it from looting on the part of the Iraqis. But when we cleared it, we actually pretty much looted it ourselves.
Yes, good point.
But we did actually, from the Ministry of Oil, we stood there and watched the Ministry of Agriculture burn to the ground. But in any event, as we went down to Karbala, you know, it's a Shiite holy city, and of course the Shia were oppressed under Saddam, so they were truly, genuinely grateful. I mean, we arrived in the city to throngs of cheering people, and little kids would line up six deep and reach out to try to shake our hands and, you know, try to take the pens off of our gear and ask what our names were and, you know, their very rudimentary English that they learned in school. And we supported the local economy with our own money while we were there. You know, we would go to the restaurants, we would eat their chicken, and there was a guy who had a satellite phone, and he would let us use it for $1.50 a minute. And, I mean, some of these people, we watched them get wealthy off of us. There was a man who usually rode a bicycle around town, and he would sell us juice, orange juice, mango, whatever. By the time we left, he was driving around a gas-powered scooter, which nobody had. You know, no Iraqi could afford that, but he'd actually made enough money off of selling us juice and whatever to buy that.
So you weren't required to buy all your food from KBR or some other contractor. You were buying stuff from the local Iraqis.
If only we could be so lucky. You know, at that point, really 95% of our food was military rations that were basically like MRE. Well, we did eat a lot of MREs, but then also T-Rats, which were just a big can of basically MREs that serves 50 Marines or whatever. But no, we were suffering from quite a bit of malnutrition by the time we left because of that. So KBR actually would have been nice.
Yeah.
But we did get to eat, you know, Iraqi food, and it was really good, mind you, because, you know, whatever they feed you, it was killed that day, you know, so it was all fresh. But we supported the local economy was the point. We had a good symbiotic relationship with the people, and they appreciated our presence, except for we started committing cultural blunders, not really realizing what we were doing or how bad it was. You know, we just thought we were occasionally irritating people, or, you know, we would act rude. And to us, it was just part of maintaining that physical dominating presence that sort of
the presence deters of an
attack,
occupying.
Deters attacks on us, you know. But we didn't understand the very serious damage we were doing to our standing in the long term. But when we left, we actually had not had a single killed in action in our entire battalion on that first tour. The city of Karbala was the safest city in Iraq at the time, and we had virtually no casualties in that entire first deployment.
And did the people of Karbala sort of express gratitude that Saddam Hussein had been overthrown, and did they express any understanding or impressions of how long the Americans planned to stay? I mean, if they had known we were staying forever, would it have made any difference to their attitude?
Well, those are both good questions. The first one, as to if they appreciated that we took Saddam out, I mean, they said so all the time. They would, people would, and that was actually the case during the entire invasion all the way to Baghdad. People would drive by in their pickup trucks and yell out the window, "No Saddam, good Bush, yes Bush." And in Karbala, kids would take out a 250 dinar bill, which was like the standard denomination, in Iraq, and every bill of every denomination has a picture of Saddam's face on it. And so they would take it out and show us the picture of Saddam, throw the bill on the ground, and then stomp on it, and say, "Saddam donkey," as if, and this to them was a very meaningful statement, and as the bottom of the foot in the Arabic world is unclean, and so for them to be stomping on his face was this huge, powerful statement. To us, it was kind of amusing, but yes, they were very expressive of their gratitude. And I actually forgot your second question, so could you repeat
the second question? Is did they have any sort of idea of whether you intended to be there for a couple weeks or intended to stay for years and years?
You know, there were some people who would ask, you know, when are you leaving? How long are you going to be here? And in the first few months, it seemed like it was just out of curiosity, you know. And we didn't have any answer for them. We didn't know. And us being Marines, our culture and our mission is supposed to be a very expeditionary, a very in-and-out sort of mission that Marines fulfill. You know, we're supposed to hit something really hard, be there for 30 days, and get out and let the Army take over. So, you know, we were kind of the mind, and we're telling them that, you know, we personally aren't going to be here very long, but as for how long the U.S. is going to stay here, we didn't really have an answer. And there were actually some people who wanted us to take over, it seemed, because there were people who could speak fairly good English, and you know, you'd get in a conversation with them and they would be sort of talking about Iraq as if it was the 51st state now, and you know, when you would say, well, no, wait, this is your country, you guys are going to govern this, they would say, no, this is no good, this is not good. And that to me just illustrates how ill thought out the whole removal of the Saddam regime was, and how little respect was had for Saddam's ability to keep Iraq stable, you know, by whatever means he did that. You can make comments, and he certainly wasn't going to win any Nobel Peace Prizes, but there was stability, and there was statehood. You know, Iraq had a functioning government and functioning social services,
which is something it hasn't had for 5 years or more, and then we should talk about that. I want to tell people how they can get in on this conversation. This is David Swanson, your host, and our guest for the next hour is Jason Lemieux, who is a board member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and we are talking about his experiences in Iraq. You can send in your questions at thepeoplespeakradio.net or call in and join us toll-free at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494. Outside the U.S. and Canada, 877-489-6350, 877-489-6350. So Jason, this was your first experience in Iraq, but you came back home and then 5 months later went back to a completely different environment. Is that right?
Yes, and, you know, we actually didn't expect to ever deploy to Iraq again, because, as I said, our understanding was that as Marines, we don't occupy, we don't do stability operations or anything like that. You know, our part in this is done. So it was actually very destructive to our morale to even be deployed to a second tour at all.
Yeah.
And when we went there, the second deployment was to a town of around 20,000 people called Hoseiba, and it's on the western border with Syria. I could literally throw a rock into Syria from where I slept. And so this town was on the very edge of the Sunni triangle. And so the Sunnis, you know, first of all, did not have it nearly as bad under Saddam. And in fact, there maybe even was a sort of a degree of protection that they enjoyed, you know, from Saddam's forces,
right,
more so than the rest of the population. So they were not grateful at all. And furthermore, Hoseiba, being on the border, was a smuggling town. You know,
smuggling
really,
what?
Well, just anything, really. I mean, you know, gasoline, food, whatever. I guess we never even really found out that much, because, you know, we were so incompetent as far as getting out there and learning something about the local population and the kind of society that we were in. But when we came in, to Haseba, and we tried to take over the border, the actual customs work there. And of course, you know, we Marines couldn't be bribed like the Iraqi customs officials could. And so we probably, to an extent, were actually harming the economy of the city by basically shutting down smuggling. And so the people were not appreciative at all. And we got mortared the first day we were there. We relieved 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, which is an army unit who had been there for quite a while. And we got mortared on the first day. We were getting attacked almost constantly. There was a period when a unit in my company was attacked by an improvised explosive device every single day for a month straight.
Wow.
The resistance there enjoyed almost total sympathy from the local population. We would get dirty looks every time we went out on patrol. We would do a lot of observation posts, and what those are basically picking a random person's house out in the city and basically taking it over to try and observe a small portion of the city and to try and catch somebody in the act of planting a roadside bomb, or IED, as it was known to us. And, you know, so that right there, that act alone, the act of taking over someone's house, oftentimes in the middle of the night, you know, humiliating this man who basically has no way to defend his honor or to protect his family in any of this. You herd the whole family into one floor of the house, or depending on how much of a jerk the squad leader was, maybe even just not even allowing them to leave a single room of the home. So that wasn't winning us any fans, and naturally the people were helping the resistance to basically operate freely in the city of Haseba. It was, for all intents and purposes, enemy-controlled territory. And towards the end of the deployment, we were actually driven out of the city. Our commanding officer's idea at first had been that we were going to do security patrols. We were going to establish a quote-unquote continuous presence in the city. So one squad, which is supposed to be around 12 or 13 Marines, but by the time we left, we had squads of 7 or 8 Marines because we'd taken so many casualties. One squad in the city at all times. So you'd go out, do an 8 or 12-hour patrol, which in and of itself is really physically and mentally impossible. I mean, nobody can keep that up for 8 or 12 hours. And then as soon as you would come back to base, another squad would go out, in and out the whole time. Well, towards the end of the deployment, the last 2 months, we actually stopped doing that. We only patrolled the two blocks that were closest to our base to prevent people from being able to, you know, establish coordinated attacks on our base, because it simply wasn't worth the cost anymore. I mean, you had squads of 7 Marines walking around the city, getting killed and hurt all the time, and never, ever able to fight back. I mean, impossible to fight back. You walk around until somebody gets blown up, then you call in a medevac and you come home. I mean, that was the story. I would argue that we were tactically defeated in the second tour.
So I've got a question for you that's sent in from Mark in Missouri, and I think you've begun to answer this question already, but Mark asks, how did the American military treat Iraqis? You say they were friendly to Iraqis, and Iraqis were friendly to you during your first tour there. Did that change in later tours?
Yes, and, you know, when they were telling us we're going to win the hearts and minds, I mean, that was a genuine order that we were given. General Mattis honestly wanted us to win the hearts and minds and really wanted to do counterinsurgency right. But the thing is we were never really taught good cultural training. We didn't understand that, you know, polite and rude in America are based on totally different actions and totally different, you know, social structures than they are in Iraq. And so we thought we were being nice oftentimes when we weren't, you know. And as that broke, as what we thought was nice didn't work, we started holding it against the Iraqis, and so you know, our behavior towards them became more and more hostile as time went on. And eventually, as I said, you know, we would herd whole families into one room, and we wouldn't allow the kids to leave the house to go to school, because if they were to leave the house, they might tip off the resistance that we were there. We wouldn't allow the men to go to work. And, I mean, these are people who are doing everything they can to feed their families anyway. And we really didn't think, well, I guess I can't generalize and say that this was universal, but many Marines really didn't care that this was such a shoddy way to treat these people, because they basically felt that, well, they're all against us. They're not telling us where the roadside bombs are and stuff, so, you know, screw them.
So you went on three tours, and this was your second tour we've been talking about. It sounds like your attitude towards the wisdom of being there at all may have begun to change on your second tour. I mean, at this point, what were you thinking about the occupation of Iraq? Is something that made sense, should be continued, should be ended, never should have been launched in the first place? What were you thinking
tour? Let me say that I never agreed with the invasion in the first place. Strategically, it never, ever made sense to me. You know, the president would trot out weapons of mass destruction. Saddam has these weapons of mass destruction. Well, weapons of mass destruction are in and of themselves strategically irrelevant when Saddam has no way to get them to U.S. soil. And, I mean, that much was known. It was printed in American newspapers, and I remember reading it in newspapers and in Newsweek and seeing it on CNN, that Saddam did not have an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the U.S. So it didn't matter how much weapons of mass destruction he had, that's not a reason to invade a country. Because he was supporting terrorists, even if it had been true, is not in and of itself a reason to invade a country. So I was never for this. But I guess on the second tour is when I really started seeing that, you know, strategy and the Constitution aside, this is really going to be... I was also against the fact that we were violating the Constitution by invading this country. But I guess in the second tour is when I really saw not just something that was strategically stupid, but something that was really a true humanitarian disaster. You know, and this is when I guess I started feeling that it wasn't something that I could just ignore, you know, and the unconstitutionality weren't things that I could just brush off anymore. You know, this was something that really had to end.
And you say that the war violated the Constitution because it violated the UN Charter, or because the Congress didn't declare the war, or in which of the many senses do you mean?
From the beginning, what bothered me from the beginning was that it violated Article 1, Section 8, at least as I understood it and still do, where Congress is given the power to make war. And, you know, in high school, in government, I was taught that that means a unanimous declaration on the part of all 535 members of Congress for the reason that if they can't all agree unanimously, then it is not worth the risk, the strategic risk involved in going to war. Because the chances are that it will cost you more than you will get in back in return. Any time you go to war, and that's something that I think any responsible leader should know. But it's only recently that I've started looking into things more, and also started to be upset also that we're violating Article 6, where we're bound to the UN Charter.
Well, it sounds like you had a good teacher, and I think they're still teaching that stuff to people in high schools, although it may not be true anymore. We're speaking with Jason Lemieux, who is a board member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. You can call in with your questions to 888-228-4494. That's toll-free, 888-228-4494. Here's a question sent in at thepeoplespeakradio.net from John in Pennsylvania. Jason, did you witness any atrocities, murder, rape, torture against Iraqis by U.S. military?
Well, you know, it's very hard to define atrocity, and there are so many shades of gray. You know, war is very, very complex. But as you stay there for three tours, and when I say as you, I mean my unit, you know, not just myself. As Marines keep getting deployed over and over again, they continue to see violent acts, and they watch their friends die. Terrible things are bound to happen because, first of all, they're becoming desensitized to violence, and secondly, they're seeing their friends get hurt and killed, and they're not able to do anything about it. They're not able to see any justice. You know, no matter how many guys get blown up, we almost never found the man that laid the bomb or the man that actually hit the trigger.
Right.
So they, it, in order to make sense of their world, to stay sane, they need to be able to fight back somehow. And when they can't find an enemy, they're going to project, you know, hostility onto the local population. So there were times when people were shot, or I believe wrongfully detained, and at the time, the Marines who were doing this may have actually genuinely believed that this person was an enemy, even though I think was looking at things from a more critical perspective than a lot of people, and I thought that, you know, chances are this guy is innocent. But to Marines, you know, when nobody is tipping them off to the fact that they're about to step on a roadside bomb, everybody's the enemy. And so that's where the complexity and the shades of gray start to come in.
So what would you say was the darkest shade of gray you saw? What was the closest thing to an atrocity that you...
Well, that I saw with my own eyes, there were incidents in which detainees were abused pretty heavily. And you know, there were times when the commanding officer, the battalion commander, actually lifted the rules of engagement almost entirely when he said that everyone on the streets is an enemy combatant. And when the battalion commander or lieutenant colonel gives those orders, Marines are going to shoot anybody on the streets. And so those Marines themselves are off the hook, you know, by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I mean, this, yeah, you know, was arguably a lawful order. So I witnessed people get shot then who, you know, were completely unarmed. And I would argue that it's murder, but I wouldn't put blame on those individual Marines who, first of all, were desensitized to violence, were socialized into this mindset, you know, that killing is the answer to problems, and then were traumatized and watched their friends die and saw horrible things. I would put the blame on that battalion commander who should never have given such an order. And, you know, I would also put the blame on the people who sent us to Iraq in the first place and could have read a history book and figured out what kind of things were going to happen as our soldiers and Marines stayed in this country for you know, months and years on end.
Couldn't agree with you more. Here's a different question from Janice in Oklahoma. Did you make any friends among the Iraqis, and are you still in contact with them?
I am not personally in contact with any Iraqis that I met, but I mean, there were ones that we made friends with, especially the ones that, you know, we were giving our money, that Marines would have, buy food and buy alcohol in some cases. And, there were a couple interpreters that we would have. And, you know, again, there's a financial relationship too, because we're paying them, but they would live on our base oftentimes, and, you know, they could speak English, and they would try to pick up American culture and American lingo and stuff, and that sort of helped endear them to us or us to them. So, you know, there were times, yeah, when there were people who we really felt were friends, and, you know, you really liked going and talking to them and hanging out with them and stuff. But pretty much when you leave at the end of the deployment, the relationship is over for the most part.
Yeah. What tell us about your third tour, because we discussed where you went for the first two. What was the third tour like?
Now, my third tour was in the city of Ramadi, and actually, as this deployment was slotted to begin in September of 2005, I was actually finishing my original four-year contract with the Marine Corps. And I was supposed to get out of the Marine Corps 5 days after my unit left on the third tour. so I wasn't going to go. But the thing was is that when I got into the Marine Corps, when I got to my unit, when I got to 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, about 50% of the unit at that time got to 3-7 with me at the same time I did. Right, so all these new guys, this huge amount of new Marines gets to the unit, and so 4 years later, we're all getting out of the Marine Corps at the same time. And we're the guys with the combat experience. So It was very, very hard. Well, it was hard on all the guys. It wasn't just me. Everybody who was getting out, it was very hard for them to leave with two tours under their belt with combat experience and see that a bunch of new Marines now were going to be sent to Iraq with very little combat experience, actually, because not only did all of these, you know, Marines on their four-year contract get out, but all of the staff non-commissioned officers and all of the commissioned officers, or at least the great majority of them, were leaving the unit because the promotion system at the higher ranks is in the Marine Corps is such that you have to jump around from one unit to another. So these guys were getting sent back, 80% new battalion with no combat experience. So I voluntarily extended my enlistment contract by 10 months to redeploy for a third tour so that I could do my part and help bring these guys home alive. So we went
so
to Ramadi.
You went back voluntarily. You weren't,
correct,
you weren't stop
yeah.
lost. Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all. I voluntarily extended, and I'll note that I did not re-enlist. I did not get any re-enlistment bonus or any benefits, except for I got the pre-deployment and post-deployment leave for free, which, you know, is really nothing. It was just to help, you know, bring these guys home alive and to pick up a little bit of experience. And as part of the agreement that I made with my commanding officer for extending my contract, I got to lead an experimental intelligence cell for Lima Company, which was rare because normally in a Marine, in the Marine Corps, intelligence is handled at the battalion level, you know, at the headquarters of about 900 Marines. They have a small number of Marines who are trained exclusively in intelligence, and that's their job in the military. But we were a bunch of, there were four of us at first, infantry Marines, who basically were going to start up this little intelligence cell from scratch and see what we could do. So we went to Ramadi, and the thing that strikes me about Ramadi, as opposed to Hoseiba, is we've been told all these horror stories about how violent it was, and the unit that was there on two tours before us, actually, it was one of the most violent cities in all the country, and they sometimes had to fight their way out of their base just to do patrols. But when we got there, it wasn't as dangerous, and it seemed to me like it wasn't that violent, or it wasn't as violent as the second tour, because the resistance had come along so far that they didn't really need to attack us as much. You know, they could see that they were winning, and it was almost like they were so comfortable that attacks didn't need to be this daily occurrence. You know, and
so did all the guys with you make it home alive then?
No, in my company, we had two killed in action, and then we had several severely wounded.
Yeah.
But we continued doing the observation post, and, you know, by this time, the Marines have no real respect for the Iraqis as you know, people. And, you know, the junior Marines are going over there. They're being taught by their superiors who have already done a tour. Everybody who'd done two tours is already out of the Marine Corps unless they'd re-enlisted or extended for this deployment. They're being taught by their superiors that, you know, all these people understand it's force and, you know, everybody is the enemy. So we didn't have any friends among the local population there. And so as we would do observation posts, we would often find that even though we had patrolled to a house under the cover of darkness, and in Ramadi there was a curfew, and when the next day came and people started walking around, Marines could be totally hidden inside the house and looking out of the windows, and little kids would point at us as they walked by. They somehow knew. I mean, they were being tipped off. the whole entire city, it was like the whole city was under enemy observation at all times. We couldn't hide. The resistance was set up so strongly there. Their networks were so well tapped in that, I mean, there was nothing we could do. That we had, we were at a complete disadvantage.
They were very
selective with their attacks at times. There was one instance when we had some Marines go down into southern Ramadi, and basically the southern two-thirds of Ramadi was enemy-controlled, literally enemy-controlled, to where United States military would not go into southern Ramadi in less than battalion strength, which, you know, was something on the order of 500 or 600 Marines with Army tanks and Bradleys. They wouldn't go down there with less than that because they knew they were going to take casualties. There was a unit that went down there, it was very rare for anybody to go down there, and they were doing patrol, and they would do this business of random VCPs, we called it. We called them snap VCPs, and VCP is short for vehicle checkpoints, where, you know, you just patrol to a, you know, intersection at random, stop for an hour, and search passing cars in the vain hopes that you're going to find somebody who's transporting weapons around in his car. You know, just very, very tactically unsophisticated way to go about business. But, I mean, it was preached to us as gospel. You know, this is the way we're going to win. But in any event, they were down there for an hour at one intersection. And one of the Marines noticed an artillery shell on the side of the road. It was an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb. So they called down an explosive ordnance disposal team to dispose of the artillery shell. Long story short, they were there. They were on scene for at least 2 hours. And the disposal team had tried to drag the artillery shell towards them with a robot so that they could defuse it. The robot broke, so they drove their Humvee out in the middle of these intersections to just pick up the artillery shell. They said, you know, screw it, you know, this is taking too long, you know, we're just going to get shot at eventually. So they drove out in the middle of an intersection. A guy steps out of the truck to pick up the artillery shell, and the road explodes underneath the Humvee. There was an artillery shell underneath the pavement. They had actually dug a hole into the road, planted the bomb, and then paved over it, and I've seen videos of it, and the road is seamless. I mean, they were so good at this, there is absolutely no way anybody could have been able to tell. They had waited 2 hours on scene. They had observed us and waited for that truck to drive over the spot where the artillery shell was, waited very patiently to get the perfect shot and totally destroy the vehicle. Two Marines were killed, and one was very seriously wounded. I had burns on over 90% of his body. And as soon as that bomb exploded, they started shooting at the Marines with machine guns and rocket propelled grenades. So, I mean, this is the level that they were at. And so they could afford to be picky and only attack us when it really meant something.
Jason, we've got to take a quick break, but I want to talk about this this warfare between a military and a population with IEDs, and you've written some great things about this that people can find at IVAW.org, which is the website for Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is a group I highly recommend supporting. We are speaking with one of its board members, Jason Lemieux, and we will be back and taking your calls at 888-228-4494 or sending your questions at thepeoplespeakradio.net. We will be back in a few.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Maybe you're me.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are speaking with Jason Lemieux of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And Jason, before the break, you were starting to talk about a subject that you've written something about that I've read, the tactical approaches involved. I read an interesting column you wrote about a year ago, a little over a year ago, called Hammers Can't Fix Computers, or Why We Lost in Iraq, Part 1. And I took your point there to be not so much that we ought to shift tactics in order to better occupy Iraq, but to communicate to the reader that there's no way we can possibly win. Or am I misreading that? Is your thinking that wiser approaches and tactics would make the occupation actually successful?
Well, to speak about strategic theory for just a sec, if you don't have a sound strategy and a sound strategic reason for invading, like Clausewitz said that war is an extension of politics by other means. So war is supposed to be achieving some reasonable, desirable political end. And if you don't have that, then there's no victory to speak of. It doesn't matter how great your military is or what they do. You can't win if you don't have a good reason for fighting in the first place. So there's no victory to be had. But when I was writing the article, what I was speaking about tactically was that the U.S. military is designed to fight the Soviet Union, on the plains of Europe. We're designed to fight an opposing state military that very clearly identifies itself and presents large identifiable targets, tanks and armored personnel carriers and whole battalions and regiments and divisions all clustered tightly together that we can just sit from as far away as possible with the largest possible weapons and just systematically reduce them into nothing, When we're not afforded that opportunity, our military flounders. It loses its advantage. And when you spend, decades, and I could even argue that we've been using that style of warfare since World War I, when you spend decades training for a style of war, a whole culture develops around it. So there's a whole culture in the U.S. military around the very centralized command and the very structured, disciplined sense of order that you use to coordinate all your forces and get them in a very tight line, minimize friendly fire, and coordinate all fires to just systematically reduce the enemy. And, in a situation like Iraq where you cannot identify the enemy, in fact, is the civilian population. I mean, these were the citizens of Ramadi and Hoseiba that we were fighting. There can be no doubt that these were people who lived there fighting us from their houses. And we're totally surrounded. We can't tightly coordinate anymore. Our order, our discipline, our centralization is worthless at that point. So this isn't, and it's not something that you can just turn around. General Petraeus wrote the new counterinsurgency manual. Well, he wasn't the only guy, but he had a large part in it. And it's called Field Manual 3 Tac 24. And it's to start using this counterinsurgency doctrine, to start getting into what we know about really winning the hearts and minds, about being very careful not to offend the population, not to use collateral damage, not to use overwhelming force, because if you harm the civilians, they're going to give their support to the enemy, to the insurgents, to the resistance fighters.
I've read a book by William Polk about these sorts of occupations and counterinsurgencies that really suggests that winning from the American point of view is virtually impossible. And then if you look at the counterinsurgency manual that I think Petraeus had some role in putting together, I guess there's at least some pretense that it might be possible, but the number of troops required, as some recommended before this invasion, is several times what are there now, and of course that's not going to happen. So what would make an occupation like this successful, and is that something we would want anyway?
Well, I would say that no, it's not something we'd want, and it goes back to, you know, at the grand strategic level, we would need to have a real reason for going in the first place for it to ever be any success, because what you need the moral high ground. You need the people to see you not as occupiers but as liberators, as people who are giving them some kind of favor. And if they don't see that, you know, then you can't win. And, you know, as you pointed out, we would need many times more troops than we are going to have in Iraq. And the thing is you also need a different kind of troops. Like I said, we have a military that is trained to escalate force, to use the largest, most powerful weapon to systematically reduce enemy forces. And it's very easy to train somebody to robotically obey orders and to just kill and destroy everything that's put in front of his face. But it's much harder to recruit and train people to have the kind of maturity and the kind of discretion and to see the shades of gray that you would need to see to really not create a huge national resistance movement that is going to drive us out of Iraq sooner or later.
Yeah.
So I would say, in our case, it can't be done. You know, you have to stop. You would have to get the recruiters out of high schools and start recruiting people with bachelor's degrees who are married and have kids and have something to lose, you know, and have some kind of life experience. And to recruit 500,000 of these people, they wouldn't want to go to Iraq because they wouldn't want to die, and they see that as meaningless. So we can't win.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. Let's bring a caller in on this conversation. Mike from California, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jason and David. Quick question for you, Jason. Who do you support for president? Who do you think is going to get us out of Iraq with the best plan? And do you feel that President Bush and Dick Cheney and his administration should be held accountable for getting us into Iraq? Thank you.
Good questions.
Yeah, well, let me just say first that Iraq Veterans Against the War is a nonprofit organization, and so we do not take a political stance. We do not support any politician for any office. My personal view is that none of the presidential candidates who have any chance of winning are really set on getting us out of Iraq in any kind of timely manner, you know. But I would lean, of course, towards, well, I might actually personally end up voting for a third-party candidate, just because I can't violate my integrity by voting for somebody that I think is just more concerned with winning than with actually helping America.
Fair enough. What about Bush and Cheney?
As for Bush and Cheney, you know, and again, this is my personal view. I am not speaking on behalf of Iraq Veterans Against the War, but I would say that, you know, the invasion of Iraq, among other things, certainly constitutes a high enough crime to you know, initiate impeachment proceedings.
I certainly think you're right, and I certainly hope we get to that. But let's go back to IVAW. When and how did you get involved with this movement of veterans opposing an ongoing war?
Well, the first time I looked them up online, I think I just vaguely heard of them somewhere. But I was in the Internet Center on my second deployment, and I just, entered a Google search for Iraq Veterans Against the War. That was the first time I found them. But because of the name Iraq Veterans Against the War, I actually thought I had to be a veteran, meaning I had to have already been discharged from the military. So I didn't actually apply until August of 2006, right after I'd been honorably discharged from the Marine Corps. It was probably in November of that year that I did my first public speaking event. I spoke to a class of college students at California State University at Northridge.
Uh-huh. And then you just recently spoke in the United States Congress, is that right?
Correct. I spoke before the Congressional Progressive Caucus with 8 other members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And we were basically trying to give them a small slice of our winter soldier testimony, because in March of 2008, I had the pleasure of, or the privilege at least, of speaking with 55 other veterans and even some Iraqi civilians in Silver Spring, Maryland, for an event called Winter Soldier, where we testified about our experiences in Iraq.
And the videos, correct me if I'm wrong, the videos of that Winter Soldier event and of the testimony in Congress 5 days ago can all be found at IVAW.org.
Well, almost all of the Winter Soldier testimonies from this march can be found on our website at IVAW.org, almost 22 hours worth. I'm not sure that they've got the congressional testimony up there yet, but you
well,
can
they've got
find...
they've got a link to C-SPAN. So it's on C-SPAN.
Okay, yeah. I know that you can if you go, there's a site called C-SPAN Junkie that actually has the full 3-hour congressional proceedings, and then also our individual speakers' testimonies are available on the 10-minute clips on YouTube also.
Well, it's terrific that there are at least some members of Congress bringing you guys in to tell some truth about what's happening over there, and it's also terrific, I think, cross your fingers, that last week the House voted down the latest bill to fund continuing the occupation. We'll see what happens now in the Senate and back in the House again. But I would tell me what you think, Jason. I would disagree a little bit with the question that Mike phoned in with, in that I'm not sure it is a president or, a new emperor who's going to get us out of Iraq. I think it might be Congress finally taking back the power that's supposed to belong to the most important branch of our government, as it's still taught in high schools, seizing that power and getting us out of Iraq. What do you think?
Well, I think that I'm no expert on national politics, so I can't predict what's going to happen, but I think really what's happening, who's going to have to really take it back, is the American people, the American taxpayers and those legally eligible to vote are threatening Congress. That's the reason that Congress is going to have to start moving closer to withdrawing funding, is because they're going to start seeing that if they don't, they are not getting reelected. Their jobs are threatened. So I would encourage anybody, who wants to see Congress or the president end the occupation of Iraq, to make it very clear that their elected leaders have no other choice. They must end it or they are out of a job forever.
Very, very, very well said. Let's bring another caller in who I think has a related question. Rain from Richmond, Virginia. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Jason, you sound like a wonderful representative for IVAW, and I thank you. I'm calling specifically about Senator Webb, who is a hero, I suppose, now to the veterans with the education GI Bill, and he's working very hard for the veterans. But while I secured a meeting for parents of veterans and active duty soldiers, it has been put off till early June, and I've been told that he is going to vote for funding, and apparently this has been his position all along, and I misunderstood when he was running that he was running on ending the war, that he is not going to do anything that jeopardizes funding for the continuing occupation. What is your suggestion for us that have senators, well, all of us have senators that have something to do with this, but particularly with him, with his son having been a veteran, how do we reach through?
Good question.
Well, you know, again, politics isn't really my area of expertise, so I don't know that I could give you a definite formula. I would say, though, that you should express, every American should express to any senator they don't want to end the war, the understanding that you are not going to vote for them, you are going to tell everyone you know not to vote for them, and, you know, that's really what you can do, and don't, you know, you can't compromise your principles, but really, there may be only so much that we can do. I mean, this senator doesn't really have to listen to any one constituent. So, you know, IVAW we're in the process of talking to a couple of labor unions, especially in the Philadelphia area, to start trying to organize strikes to tell the American people, you know, or to give the American people some power to withdraw their support. And I mean, sacrifices are going to have to be made. You know, we can't just vote people into power and then call their office occasionally, you know, and expect them to solve our problems for us. The American people are going to have to withdraw their own support. And it's painful to hear, but it's just something that I think has to be done.
I think you're right, Jason. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I can't resist asking a follow-up, because it's interesting to hear all this talk about this GI Bill and money for veterans care when it's actually a GI amendment. And without the bill with this massive amount of additional war money to create thousands of additional injured veterans, it doesn't fly. It's an amendment that goes along with that. And so, of course, Senator Webb, who's making his whole shtick this care for veterans money, is going to vote for this mammoth amount of money borrowed from our grandchildren to create more injured veterans. And so how do we say to our senators, and maybe more effectively to our representatives, because they're up for election every 2 years, it's no excuse to vote for more war money to say, well, I'm voting for some money for veterans, because you could do that separate from the war money. I don't know that I've always taken any position on the GI Bill, but personally, what do you recommend telling people and telling Congress members, because we'd all love to see veterans cared for, but we don't want to continue the war?
Well, you know, I mean, that's something that it's very convenient for any congressperson or senator to say, you're not supporting the troops if you don't support this war funding, because, you know, we've written on this veterans benefits bill. And I think the American people oftentimes don't understand that a congressperson or senator can propose a bill basically saying anything they want. So they could just write these independent bills, you know, to support veterans education or post-traumatic stress disorder treatment or anything. It doesn't have to be written into the war funding.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's something that, and if people don't understand that, you know, there's very little that they can effectively do to convince their representatives and their senators to change their ways. You know, I mean, that's something that the American people just have to be informed to a certain degree before they can effectively influence representatives and senators who basically are not in any threat to do anything that they don't want. You know, and I think also people just need to understand that supporting the troops is thrown around, you know, so easily. But I personally would not would not want this GI Bill to go through unless I could see where the funding was coming from and see that the taxes were going to be raised to pay for this, that we were going to take the revenue from some existing source instead of just throwing it on the national credit card so that, you know, as you said, our grandchildren just end up paying for veterans to go to college today. I mean, that's just fighting one injustice by creating another.
Well said. I think we are out of time, but Jason Lemieux with Iraq Veterans Against the War, thank you very, very much for your time. We appreciate everything you're doing, and keep doing it.
Well, thank you.
And those who want to know more can go to IVAW.org and support Iraq Veterans Against the War. This is the People Speak Radio. Tomorrow evening, Wednesday the 21st, our guest will be Mary Pallant, who is the Democratic candidate for Congress from a district in Southern California around the area of Ventura. I have met her. She's a wonderful candidate, and it should be a very interesting discussion. Please support this program. We cannot do it without your help, and that means your financial help. Go to thepeoplespeakradio.net. Speak with you again tomorrow night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall by the relief of death, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.